Hello, 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 and welcome to the review section of a special issue of the Engage Scholar Journal on Engaging Feminism, Challenging Exceptionalist Imaginaries. My name is Andy Schwartz, and my colleague Morgan Bim and I will be reviewing season 4 of Hannah McGregor's podcast, Secret Feminist Agenda. I was particularly excited to be invited to review this project because my research to date has been focused on femme internet culture. And I basically argued throughout my dissertation that memes and selfies are forms of femme theorizing. My undergraduate degree is in journalism from Carleton University, and I was a freelance journalist and writer before starting my graduate studies. So disseminating my research and my other, like otherwise kind of scholarly ideas to a more general or wider non-academic audience has always been part of my practice. I've published bits of my scholarship in Canadian publications Extra, Horizons, and Flair. I also write a zine series called Soft Femme that is all about femme theory, and I run an academic Instagram account called Acafemic. So I am very excited to be reviewing a podcast in a scholarly journal. So excited that I had to invite my frequent collaborator, Morgan Bim, to help me because she actually introduced me to the Secret Feminist Agenda podcast when she assigned it to me in her Queer Pedagogy seminar series back in, what was that, 2019? So hello, Morgan, and thank you for joining me for this review. Would you introduce yourself and some of the many hats you'll be wearing for this review?
Absolutely. Hi, Andy. I love how we pretend like we never talk when really we talk all the time. And this is just, you know, a continuation of many of the conversations that we already have. Yeah, so as Andy has explained, we are pals and frequent collaborators. We met in the Gender, Feminist, and Women's Studies PhD program at York University here in Toronto. And my research, like Andy's, is kind of preoccupied with this idea of what it means to think about cultural production in a way that privileges spaces of low culture and DIY cultures, in addition to the more kind of traditional modes of cultural production that are taken up and kind of valorized by the university. So my own research, my dissertation project, looks at the cultural mainstreaming of 2000s indie rock. And I study the TV, the film, and early internet cultures of the era. And then, as Andy mentioned, I've also been involved in some organizing and some programming in the department, putting together this kind of scrappy DIY queer pedagogies collective that offers workshops and seminars to graduate students and early career faculty across the university, as well as an accessible one-day conference with another colleague of ours, Margot Feldman. So yeah, super stoked to be here, super stoked to be talking about Secret Feminist Agenda. I've been a longtime podcast lover, and Secret Feminist Agenda was actually one of the podcasts that originally got me really excited about pods as a form of media and a form of feminist conversation.
I was wondering if, like, before we get into the conversation about the themes of this season 4, if you wanted to give us a little overview of what the podcast is all about.
For those of you who are familiar with Hannah McGregor's work or who are Secret Feminist Agenda listeners, it's not her first podcast. She originally started Witch Please, which is a feminist Harry Potter rewatch pod with her colleague and pal Marcel Cosman when they were both based in Edmonton. And then Secret Feminist Agenda is kind of her second podcast project that she began as she kind of left postdoc world and entered into her position as a full-time faculty at Simon Fraser University. Both podcast projects, but Secret Feminist Agenda in particular, is kind of invested in recreating the best parts of academia. I think there's one quote from episode 4.8, so from earlier in the season that we're reviewing today, and they're saying, you know, if Witch Please was about kind of recreating and amplifying the best parts of a graduate seminar, an upper year seminar course, getting really nerdy and talking about texts that we really enjoy, Secret Feminist Agenda is really about kind of distilling and pulling out the best parts of, you know, chatting with a colleague at a conference or kind of approaching somebody after a panel to pick their brain about that one really cool thing that they said. So it's a series of conversations, but it's also a series of conversations that's really interested in illuminating and getting really excited about, you know, different aspects of feminist life, to borrow from Sarah Ahmed, right? And activism and academia and kind of academia adjacent ways of moving through the world that we can learn from together.
Thank you for that overview. So yeah, we're going to be focusing on season four. And so I think we'll just kind of dive into some of the themes that we pulled out in our review. The first one that I wanted to highlight is one I'm calling critiquing the expert, or the notion of expertise. You know, in the project of like low theory and public scholarship, I think that this is a really important theme. There are some like really specific examples, like in episode four about, it's called Off Mic Conversations. So there's like this specific critique of Foucault and like, can we stop centering Foucault in a conversation about citational practice? And I think in the same conversation, there's also, they talk about Margaret Atwood and like the role that the academic structures play in like creating these like superstar academics, I guess. So they're kind of saying like, well, if programs, English departments would stop assigning Atwood, maybe we could, you know, stop talking about her. So I thought that this was a really, really interesting theme. And it showed up in a couple of different ways, like around who is the expert? And I think that this is like a feminist contention. This notion of who is the expert has been a real question. This kind of conversation really brings into focus the importance of alternative or DIY media like podcasts as one of the ways that we can critique expertise as well as circulate other points of view.
Yeah, I mean, I think we both agree that this was a really prominent theme across the pod, but in this season in particular. And I think it works in a couple of different ways. As you already alluded to, like, I think there's this idea of locating expertise and locating, you know, knowledge outside of traditional academic structures. And this functions both in like the materiality of the podcast itself and like what that means from a production point of view and a research output point of view, but also, you know, the folks that Hannah is talking to and interviewing. I think it also functions in terms of age and seniority. So we have like a couple of really wonderful episodes from the season where Hannah McGregor is interviewing younger scholars, emerging scholars, her RA for the Spoken Web Project in one point, right? Stacey Copeland. And so I think there's this troubling of the idea that, you know, knowledge can only flow in one direction. Mm-hmm. And younger scholars are always kind of primed to learn from their mentors and from older folks within the academy. There's that as well.
Yeah, I think like this idea shows up in both, and I think it's important to mention like in both form and content. So I was talking about like citational practice, who are we citing, who are we assigning, why, like, and how do we contribute to creating this expert? But also like, you know, the academy as the only way in which expertise can be produced. One of the like mini-sodes that like stood out to me is like episode three on enthuse. So I wanted to note this one because in this episode, Hannah McGregor is talking about like bringing enthusiasm to her work and how like the kind of idea of a rigorous, prestigious scholar is like one that's like very serious and unaffected. The critique of that was like bringing in your enthusiasm for your work and like how does that change the shape of academia? So I thought that was also really, really interesting.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think one of the things that really drew me to Hannah McGregor's work when I discovered her, you know, all those years ago was kind of like the joy with which mm-hmm. and like the enthusiasm with which she approaches these conversations. A really common refrain on the Witch Please podcast with Marcel Cosman was, we're critiquing this thing or we're talking about this thing because we love it so much. Mm-hmm. You know, the notion of critique and joy isn't mutually exclusive and shouldn't be mutually exclusive because it actually makes for much stronger scholarship.
Yeah, I love that point. And I think that's also like one of the other things I love about the pod, like this podcast, is like that it's a way of critiquing expertise, but also like offering something else, because I don't think it's that exciting or that helpful really to only offer critique. Like, I think it's really amazing when people offer a critique paired with creation. So that's what I really appreciate about it. And I think that that's like brings a bit of nuance to like that, like joy and criticism that you're just talking about.
Yeah. And I think a theme that kind of emerges over the course of this season in particular, you know, it began in summer 2019 and wrapped in late 2020. So it really kind of did encompass the COVID-19 pandemic kind of taking over the collective consciousness. This theme of hope becomes really, really important, particularly later in the in the season. And I know we'll probably talk about this a bit more, but yeah, just kind of returning to this idea that these aren't mutually exclusive ideas or affects. You know, we can critique and we can have these scholarly conversations, but it's also important to kind of retain a hope and joy and like connection in the midst of all of that as well.
Yeah, that's a really, really beautiful sentiment, because we're kind of already talking about affect. Like, one of the other themes that we had noted we wanted to talk about was the politics and affects of space. So I really appreciate the connection in episode 14 with one of the owners of Iron Dog Books about the ways that like physical spaces become community hubs, and like the politics and the systems that either enable or disable this. So they're talking about, you know, the act of curation in a bookstore, and like what politics that are involved in your curation of your inventory can be welcoming or signal like the kind of expectations for the space in a way. And so they're talking about small businesses, and they were talking about also, you know, in Vancouver, much like here in Toronto, like the cost, but maybe even worse, the cost of housing is like astronomical. And so they were thinking about these two things in relation to each other. Like, we are often thinking about the cost of housing, but they also brought into the conversation the cost to small businesses of operating and how these two things go together. So I thought that was really interesting. So thinking about the politics of the creation of space in this really broad, but also like interlocking, overlapping way was really, really interesting.
Totally. And I think it's really interesting as well. You know, season four begins very grounded in the physical space, you know. Mm-hmm. In the first episode, Hannah McGregor is explaining that because, you know, she's had a few years to settle into Vancouver, she's really invested in this idea of exploring the local and really exploring those connections to local businesses and activists and other, you know, community members. And obviously that's really turned on its head as the season goes on. COVID-19 arrives on the scene, and everything is kind of forced to shift into this much more insular kind of production mode, you know, recording over Zoom and speaking to folks from further away. So again, I think there's this kind of parallel thing at work here where the content of the season, similar themes are kind of reflected in the production and in the materiality of the podcast itself.
Yeah, I think it was also really interesting. So now we are in calendar year 3 of COVID-19 as we are, you know, recording this episode or this review. So I like noted that it was really interesting to be listening to something. I think it was kind of the first time I was listening back to something that was happening, that was like kind of watching the pandemic hit.
Yeah, just that dissonance, I guess, between those two spaces, you know, the recording space and the listening space now, two plus years later, it's definitely interesting.
Yeah, obviously like recording over Zoom like we're doing now doesn't sound as intimate sometimes, because you can hear space in between the guest and the host. I think it was really around like episode 16, which is a conversation with Kai Chung Tom, where this shift really happens. And I think that's really interesting too, like to think about like loss of community like happening because of a pandemic, also in relation to a lot of Kai Chung Tom's work, which is like about kind of like disposability, or like, I kind of want to avoid using the term cancel culture because it's just like super loaded. But yeah, I think they talk a lot about like accountability, disposability, and these kinds of community politics. So it was interesting to think about, I guess, yeah, like the kind of scale of loss of community that can happen. So it was kind of like a really acute reminder of like the importance of community and like our responsibility to community. Is there like a way in which we can think about this podcast as an act of creating community or showing responsibility for community?
Yeah, it's a great question, right? And I think something else that they spent a lot of time chatting about in this particular episode is this idea that, you know, there are groups of folks who have been innovating and who have been building community in alternative ways forever. So queer folks and racialized folks, trans folks, you know, and so this idea that, and which I think we've all, you know, engaged in conversations about this at some point over the last 2 years, but this idea that the pandemic has really forced us to come face to face with the ways in which we can't always rely on institutions and governments and mm-hmm. universities to look after us. And so like, what would it look like to invent alternative or, you know, historically very precedented, but still non-traditional ways of reaching out and connecting and folding folks into our spaces and into our communities in a way that is still safe.
Yeah. And I think we'd also had some thoughts about thinking about what it does to take these conversations public and the kinds of extra responsibilities that a host takes on in volunteering this scholarship and activism and, you know, like just kind of political discussions and such in such a public way. I guess I'm thinking about this in relation to the Iron Dog Books episode about like you do what you can to create a particular space and that communicates kind of inherently what the expectations are when you're in this space. But then there is also, I think Hannah mentions at some point, the kind of jarring in a way, like experience of like realizing that like, oh, not everyone who listens to this podcast shares the exact same kind of politics. And then what do you as the host do with that information? What responsibility do you have as a podcast host or other kind of public intellectual, I guess, to respond?
Yeah, there's a way in which, to a certain extent, you know, the responsibility or the accountability of public facing work is so much different and in some ways so much more than kind of traditional academic publishing avenues. Obviously, we're doing this very funny thing of reviewing a scholarly podcast for a scholarly journal via podcast. So we thought it might be worth some time kind of talking about the form itself and sort of what opportunities might be offered here that other media don't.
Yeah, so I think this really connects to like the first theme that we mentioned is like the idea of critiquing the expert and creating this space in which this critique can exist. So a lot of the conversations are with academics and many are not too, but like it's like a space in which like the critiques of the institution can be made because they're not like, it's not bound by the structure of being held within the institution. Also in doing that, in like having having like these conversations with like such a wide range of feminist thinkers, the podcast really demonstrates the feminist scholarship, feminist pedagogy, feminist activism happens in like a wide variety of mediums. So that includes like sex therapy, comedy, podcasting, of course, art, and all other kinds of forms. So it shows really that critique does not belong to the academy and like scholarship does not belong to the academy.
What is kind of uniquely feminist about podcasts and about this scholarly podcast in particular? If we think about podcasts just again, as a form, putting on a media studies scholar hat, yeah, they are, you know, in many ways, a lot more accessible for folks than taking a class or then stepping into traditional university spaces. And so that question of accessibility and of having conversations and choosing language that is going to be kind of legible to a wider audience, I think is a really core tenet and a really core value of the Secret Feminist Agenda project as a whole?
Yeah, I actually really enjoyed, there was like a couple of episodes on the podcast about podcasting or like talking to other podcasters, which very I think meta. Were kind of, yeah, very meta. And I think they were like some of my favorite episodes. One of the things that really stood out to me was like in the conversation with Stacey Copeland was the idea of like voice and particularly women's voices. And women's voices are being interpreted as like not very intelligent sounding, not very scholarly sounding, and not very serious sounding. And this has been taken up by a couple of different people. I thought it was really interesting that like Hannah talking about like the practice of doing a podcast, like helped to develop this confidence in her own voice and like just a comfort with speaking, which I think is just like a very feminist outcome, which is probably not even planned, but it's something that's happened, I think, over through the course of podcasting.
Totally. I mean, I think whether we're conscious of it or not, right? I think a lot of us kind of come up through academic and scholarly spaces with this idea that, you know, traditionally, quote unquote, male voices confer authority. There's all mm-hmm. sorts of writing on like NPR voice, right? And kind of Ira Glass and that whole that whole vibe. And so I think this idea that Secret Feminist Agenda is kind of modeling this type of academic conversation that is not invested in recreating that and is in fact openly critical of that. You know, we're keeping in the laughs, we're keeping in the jokes and the curse words. And alongside all of that, there's this really intense, wonderful conversation about theory and about activism happening, you know. Again, this idea that those two things aren't mutually exclusive is really powerful. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I guess just related to this question of, you know, what are the possibilities and what are the opportunities for scholarly podcasts, you know, this idea of intimacy and of an audio medium potentially being a really effective way to build a listener's or an audience's connection to the ideas being discussed. Obviously, I'm intensely biased because I'm a popular music studies scholar, but I think this idea of there being a particular kind of space that is created whenever you're kind of listening in on these kinds of conversations is a really important one. And it's definitely something that I've felt over the years as a frequent podcast listener.
Yeah. And so one of the reasons I like really wanted you to join me in this review is because you are moving into a research project about podcasts. So I wanted to also hear, like, in your framing of that project, what do you think is scholarly about a podcast? And what do you think is feminist about a podcast?
I mean, I think the thing that's really incredible about podcasts is it has the capacity to be such a grassroots form of media, right? Mm-hmm. It's not always. And I think obviously it's really hard. You still have to have certain types of technical knowledge and certain types of access and privilege to create, like with anything else. But by and large, like, I think the reason why we've seen podcasts emerge as this really exciting space for women and queer folks and racialized folks who have been kind of historically kept out of mainstream media spaces is because of that question of possibility and of access. Yeah. And by those same virtues, like, I think a lot of those same things continue to kind of preclude podcasts from being folded into media and Canadian media writ large. So there's one episode, I think it might be in the Stacey Copeland episode. They definitely discuss it at some point this season where, you know, podcasts continue to not be included under certain federal arts granting structures. Mm-hmm. So there's still a fairly new form of media, and they're still not really accounted for in a lot of the ways that would both lend legitimacy to them as a space for conversation and also like support their future as well. Like, I know one of the big conversations happening in, you know, podcast scholarship is this question of like archiving, like how are these things being preserved? And how are these conversations, you know, being cared for. And so that future, you know, future audiences, and in this case, future scholars, can kind of go back and tap into the conversations happening here. And so as much as it's, we can talk about the project of Secret Feminist Agenda as being really interesting from a, you know, from a publishing perspective, from a point of view where we're kind of critical of traditional academic outputs, and we're seeing that terrain kind of shift and change in real time, I think it's also a really valuable project for the attention that it's bringing to the ways in which we can preserve podcasts and kind of, yeah, and the ways that we can put them in this framework where they're valuable, not just for the conversations as they're happening now, but, you know, for people to return to those in time.
You know, I think we are both scholars who do like what Morgan often terms as like public-facing scholarship, I think is your term, that the term that you use the most. But yeah, this sort of, accessible forms of scholarship. So when we're doing a podcast or a zine or whatever that's scholarly, I think the question of rigor comes up, because outside of the academy, outside of the structures of the peer review and the standardized, article and, like a dissertation, all of these different kinds of structures, outside of that, how do we know that it's scholarly? And I'm laughing because this is a bit of a devil's advocate question, but it's an opportunity to talk about it. So just curious about like your thoughts on that, Morgan.
I think in a lot of ways, the gift or the opportunity of a Secret Feminist Agenda is kind of offering this alternate model, right? So rather than kind of reproducing or reifying those traditional values of academic publishing, which is, exclusivity, we're going to hide it behind a paywall, and, you're going to have a particular type of vocabulary to engage with these ideas. The rigor that Hannah McGregor brings to the project, and there is a lot of rigor, but it kind of takes a different form. It's like, are we covering all of our bases? Are we considering intersectionality in particular kinds of ways? And so I don't think it's any less rigorous. I think it's perhaps just offering a different framework.
Right. Like it's rigorous in its commitment to feminist politics, which include accessibility, which include the critique of the academy as this inaccessible, often violent institution that excludes particular groups of people on purpose.
Yeah, absolutely. I have here written in my notes as well, care as a kind of rigor. Mm-hmm. I think in previous seasons of Secret Feminist Agenda, there was a self-care corner where Hannah and, her guests very, very explicitly kind of engage with these questions of like what care might look like within these structures. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think there's a lot of potential, and there's a lot of power in those types of rigor as well. Mm-hmm. What does it look like to build those kinds of mechanisms into our practices as scholars from the ground up?
Yeah. And I think that's like really important project for feminist scholarship in general.
Totally.
But I also think, so like we were having this conversation, we're like, okay, so maybe there might be critiques of this podcast or other kinds of public scholarship that are about rigor, because maybe there's like some hesitancy to let go of these structures. Critiques might come from people who obviously benefit from these structures, who like the exclusivity of the institution and all of that. But I do think it is also like so important to note that like Hannah, in collaboration with a few other folks, have worked to develop guidelines for peer reviewing podcasts. So there are guidelines for it to be rigorous in like similar ways to other kinds of work produced in the academy. So I think that that's really, really interesting. I think the other three seasons of Secret Feminist Agenda have been peer reviewed. And the peer reviews were also done kind of in podcast form, well, like in recorded form. And we're starting to see now, I think, other projects taking up the podcast as a potential scholarly output of their research and using these same guidelines that have been developed by Hannah through the Amplified Podcast Network. So Hannah and colleagues. So the, yeah, so podcasting isn't outside of the concept of rigorous scholarship. It is actually becoming adapted or like, I think, folded in to the structure.
More and more so. And I think that's also part of just like a wider conversation happening across academia, you know, as the field or as the industry becomes more precarious, you know, we're looking to these ways of kind of troubling traditional ways of doing things, because honestly, they don't serve a lot of scholars. They don't serve a lot of, especially young and emerging scholars. Mm-hmm. We're learning that we can't really count on these traditional and, like, I'm just going to go ahead and say outdated modes of publishing or of, you know, kind of moving through academic space. And so I think it's really exciting that we had this moment in our chat the other day. I think it's really exciting that something that is so explicitly challenging those norms is happening in Canada and is happening in such an exciting kind of project form.
Yeah, totally. So then the other point of critique, I guess, we wanted to engage with is the kind of format of the alternating minisodes versus long form interview on alternating weeks.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think just going back to the podcast as a form where you are perhaps a little bit more vulnerable as a scholar, right? You are perhaps a little more accountable to your public. I think Hannah McGregor is very explicit from the top of this season about aiming to make it a more sustainable project. So switching to a twice monthly, or she calls it fortnightly, publication schedule. And another kind of conceit of that sustainability model is alternating shorter minisodes with these longer interviews. We can definitely kind of draw a direct line that conversation about sustainability and that transparency to those feminist values that we were just talking about. And then I think there's also another really important conversation to be had, which you brought up, Andy, around the particular kinds of conversations and particular kinds of affect that kind of show up in these minisodes versus the longer, sometimes more focused interview format.
Yeah, and I think that part of the reason why the minisodes are important is because they do bring, and I think, like, you know, going back to episode 3 enthused, I think Hannah's quite explicit about wanting to bring, you know, affect into your scholarly identity and your scholarly practice. And that is part of critiquing, you know, as like we kind of mentioned at the top, critiquing the structures of the academy that, you know, is like such a crucial element of this podcast project. And I also wanted to note that Carla Rice is a scholar at University of Guelph who actually was one of the peer reviewers, I think, of season 2, if not other seasons of Secret Feminist Agenda. But I just wanted to like kind of note that in her review of it, the minisodes were actually a standout for her. So we were like, while we were wondering like, oh, are they as valuable for other people, Carla Rice in particular, like this was like a highlight. And I think that they were a highlight because they offered this sort of meditative opportunity. So taking like a little break and also having the opportunity to talk about like feelings more, like feelings or affect or things that aren't so more maybe internal. Anyways, I just wanted to note that. I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, I guess totally. I think one metaphor, one analogy I'd maybe want to draw on here. Again, my research is in feminist popular music studies, and so I'm thinking a lot about these questions of, you know, publics and audiences and what it means to be accessible to fans in particular ways. It feels weird to self-identify as a fan of Hannah McGregor, but here we are. But there's this notion that I've run across in my research of, like, you know, backstage versus front stage spaces. And so particularly in writing around things like, you know, punk house shows, you know, one of the values and one of the kind of cool things about those types of performances is that the performers are so accessible and they are just kind of like right on your level, both figuratively and literally. And so I think, you know, we can talk about podcasts on the whole as a medium or as a form that doesn't have a lot of backstage space, or certainly less so than something like a peer-reviewed journal article. And I think to a certain extent that's mediated obviously by editing, by the choices that the host makes. But I think there's something really cool happening in the mini-sodes where Hannah's actually really intentionally calling attention to that and kind of like welcoming you into the more kind of mundane or everyday or kind of that, like that backstage space even more, which is perhaps why they kind of resonate so much with particular listeners.
Yeah, it's really interesting to think about the form and like what it does. Okay, so what do you think are some of the like explicit objectives of season 4 of Secret Feminist Agenda?
Yeah, I mean, I think I keep coming back to this idea of connection, right? Like, I think Hannah is really explicit about, at the end of the day, this started out as a project for her to meet people and find friends in a new community and kind of have these conversations within a bit more of a structured container. And so I think in that regard, you know, it's a complete success. There's been 4 wonderful seasons and like tons of incredible guests, and you know, us as audiences, as listeners, have kind of joined her on that journey. So I think in very simplistic terms, it accomplished those objectives.
Yeah, and I think one of the goals for this season anyways, like from the outset, was named as keeping it local, and it's obviously became complicated with the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic. But I think that like throughout, like as we've noted, like the kind of idea of place and space like remained constant. I do think that it like really succeeded in making us think about space, like the spaces and places in which feminist activism or public intellectualism can occur, like by talking to all sorts of different feminists in different fields, doing different projects. And I think many of the guests on the podcast really talked about like the creation of space, whether it was through like the bookstore episode or like through like histories of drag, thinking about spaces as they evolve. I think that was actually like pretty successful.
The only other thing I guess I would add to that, or like the only other thing that comes to mind about this question of objectives, is that there was a really, this came up a few different times over the season, but there was a really explicit and really gorgeous conversation in the very final episode of this season with Gina Zarosky around this question of, you know, what does it mean to even have objectives for activism or for feminist work? Because so much of the time, you know, I think I used this metaphor the other day when we touched base, but I think so much of the time, you know, there isn't a kind of finite task or a place that you'll get to where you feel like it's finished, you know. Mm-hmm. The goal is really just kind of doing the thing or trying the thing in new ways, and kind of like leaving more room for those who come up behind us. And I think in that way, I mean, it's kind of a horrible paradox, right? It's a goal about not having goals, but I think in that way, Secret Feminist Agenda is also kind of modeling this process where, you know, the way that scholarly publishing works is being kind of questions and broken apart and put back together. And so maybe the goal is that there is no goal. Maybe the goal is just that it happened and it was cool and we got to listen, you know? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I also thinking about like the theme for this special issue of the Engaged Scholar Journal, thinking about like collaboration. And I think producing things in collaboration is still, I think, a bit of a friction against the idea of like the individualist neoliberal scholar. So I think that like in seeking out to like interview all of these different people about their ways of engaging with feminism, you know, broadly, is a really, you know, is demonstrative of like, yeah, like a critique of neoliberalism, the neoliberal university. And I think, yeah, like in a kind of like the, what is the theme? Like challenging exceptionalist imaginary. So it's like, we don't get there on our own. Collaboration is really important. And I think that like doing a podcast with all of these interviews with all these people and like, you know, still emphasizing citational practice, even like throughout, even though it's a podcast and it's, you don't necessarily read it, but like there's the show notes and, you know, there's ways of citing people like through speech, of course. So I think that like the form of a podcast is, yeah, really underscores those kind of feminist challenges to the university that are about like collaboration and politicizing citational practice. So I think in that way too, it succeeds at like creating a model of feminist scholarship.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that kind of brings us full circle. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you know, you were asked to do this review, you invited me on board. And so I hope, yeah, in some small way, I hope this kind of peek into our process of thinking about this podcast and this project kind of mirrors those same politics and those same objectives.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of your talking about the backstage analogy. And when we were like kind of conceptualizing this, how we were going to do this review, we had kind of thrown around this idea of like calling this podcast / review like Show Your Work, because the conversations, it's like actually kind of cool to be able to have access to like the conversation part, like which feels like more like the backstage part of like the review, like where we're kind of working it out, we're kind of, it's not like concise and finely tuned yet. So, and I think it's really important to kind of show the process, and I think that's also kind of what a podcast does, like you've mentioned, like it invites an audience into like the more intimate process of thinking rather than only showing the like very polished final product.
Yeah, the more intimate and also like the more kind of gatekept, for lack of better terms. Like I think we've both had lots of conversations about the kind of, you know, the knowledge that you only, or the things you only find out about the university once you're in the university. Mm-hmm. And so I think kind of making that messy, you know, work in progress a little more public and a little mm-hmm. more legible is only going to encourage people who are maybe intimidated by that kind of, those kinds of like institutional knowledge that they wouldn't otherwise have access to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's really cool. But I will be interested to see how podcasting does get folded into, you know, scholarship and how we'll feel about it. Yeah. You know, as it just becomes more integrated.
Yeah, and how it will kind of probably continue to exist in tension.
Yeah,
with these longer ideas about institutional legitimacy and authority.
Yeah, to be continued. So thank you everyone for listening to our podcast style review of season 4 of the podcast Secret Feminist Agenda by Hannah McGregor. I'm Andy Schwartz. You can find me on the internet on Instagram at Acafemic or my website, andyschwartzwrites.com.
Thank you to Andy for having me on this one-off episode of ESJ Reviews. You can find me on the internet at morganbim.com or on Twitter at Bimbles. That's B-I-M-M-B-L-E-S because I am very fun.
This review was recorded in Toronto, Canada, a place originally known as Ticoronto, which has been taken care of by the Anishinaabeg Nation, the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, and the Huron-Wendat. I enjoy it more than I enjoy it.